This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Major climate reports released over the past several months have driven home the message that human-caused climate change is a reality, and not just for future generations. Some impacts of global warming are inevitable and already beginning. As surprising and sobering as that may be to many people, one scientist has been arguing that, in fact, the history of human influence on climate dates back thousands of years, meaning that none of us alive today have ever lived on a planet with a natural climate. Dr. Bill Ruddeman is professor emeritus at University of Virginia. He proposed the early Anthropocene theory a little over a decade ago, and he joins me in our Woods Hole studio to talk about where the idea stands today. Bill Ruddeman, welcome to Living Lab.
Glad to be here.
Let's start generally with this idea that has become, I think, increasingly popular and accepted within the scientific community of calling this era, this time that we live on a geological scale, the Anthropocene, essentially the idea that one of the overriding factors on a global scale at this point on climate, on extinction rates, on the water cycle, is humans. Where did that idea kind of come from?
It grew organically within the community, but at one point, Paul Crutzen, who's a Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist, he was sitting at a meeting and he just suddenly sat back and said, wait a minute, we're talking about the Anthropocene, the anthropogenic era, the time when humans dominate the planet. For example, we've moved more Earth than all the geologic erosion agents that affect the planet. So large-scale effects like that and the ones you just mentioned.
Is this becoming a formal technical term, or is it still more of a public relations effort?
That's a very good question. There are those who want it to become a formal term, but they're arguing about when it began, when the anthropogenic era began. There are people like me who think it's a very useful informal term to convey to the public that we're having a huge influence on the planet. But my experience is that when you try and put formal definitions on things, you tend to put them into a straitjacket. And the interest is in the actual things that happen and all the variety of things that happen.
I mean, we don't have an era that's named the Saurocene for dinosaurs, or, you know, even though they dominated the planet.
Well, we do have all these geologic epic names that go back, more than a billion years. So geologists in the past have formally named things, but this is much more recent. And there's the question of whether it's necessary. Again, I think it's hard to put any one time as the start of the era of human influences. It's a growing phenomenon that's been growing for thousands of years. And so I'm in the camp that doesn't want to give it a formal name, just to use it, but keep it informal.
Now, you are a proponent of a version of this informally called the early Anthropocene, which you were just talking about, this debate about when significant human influence on a global scale began. And we tend to think about that as being 150, 200 years ago, Industrial Revolution, the rise of fossil fuels. And that's when we kind of start thinking about human impacts on climate change. But you argue that this has been going on for thousands of years. How long do you think humans have been influencing global climate?
Well, this early phase, first off, the industrial era is a step function departure from what has happened before. The influence, the changes in the last 150, 200 years are much larger than, in many cases, than what has happened in the past. But important things did happen in the past. Agriculture began to originate in round numbers around 10,000 years ago in Southwest Asia, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Fertile Crescent, and in Northern China. And then it subsequently originated thousands of years later in various other places. So it pops up or it appears progressively in different areas, and then it expands and expands. So to put a number on it, the way I got into this debate was looking at greenhouse gas concentrations in ice cores. There's old air bubbles trapped in ice cores. They can be dated. And to put it in a real brief nutshell, I noticed that some greenhouse gas trends that under natural factors should have been decreasing steadily. There are natural variations in climate, ice ages and interglacials. They should have been going down, and they turned around and started going up in round numbers 7,000 years ago for carbon dioxide, the big greenhouse gas, and 5,000 years ago for methane. And I thought that's strange, and spent a couple of years trying to figure out what natural process could have caused that, since my understanding was that the natural processes should have pushed the gases in the other direction.
Well, talk a little bit more about how you do distinguish how we would have known what the natural processes and natural trends should have been several thousand years ago.
I'll give you one example. The methane concentration in the atmosphere, the second most important greenhouse gas that humans can produce, is strongly dependent on the area of wetlands on the planet, most of which are in the northern hemisphere, because most of the land's in the northern hemisphere. And the cycles of the size of the wetlands are driven by the strength of the monsoons, which are driven by the strength of the incoming solar radiation from the sun. And the incoming solar radiation changes because of changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun. So 11,000 years ago, incoming radiation in the summer, which is what drives the monsoon, did create extensive wetlands, which were emitting large amounts of methane. As you come towards the present, the subsequent 10 or 11,000 years, that solar radiation forcing, we call it, was decreasing, which should have decreased the size of the wetlands, and it did. There's plenty of geologic evidence for that. And the methane concentration went down from 11,000 to 5,000 years ago, as it should have, because the wetlands are shrinking. But then 5,000 years ago, it turns and goes the wrong way. So
the solar radiation is still going down, but the methane turns around and starts going up.
That's exactly right. So all across northern Africa, south of the Sahara, across southern Arabia, across India, across China, the wetlands are drying out. So the methane should be decreasing in concentration in the atmosphere, but it turns around and goes the wrong way. And so it's basically that one simple observation that got me intrigued enough to start studying something that's taken up my last 10 years.
Now, you, as I understand, began your career as a marine biologist.
Geologist. Yes.
How did you get from that to looking at the monsoons and the history of the relationship between monsoons and wetlands?
Well, I guess the answer is I started off as more of a specialist, as most people do right after their degrees. And I was looking at microfossils in North Atlantic sediments that showed the cooling and warming of the ocean in response to the ice sheets that were growing nearby. But I was always the kind of person that was interested in the bigger picture. And so instead of staying as a specialist, I became more of a generalist. And so after finishing work on the North Atlantic, I worked for a period of time on uplift of the Tibetan Plateau, which was a factor driving the cooling of the last 50 million years that led us into the whole ice age interval. The Northern Hemisphere ice sheets have been around cycling in and out for 3 million years. So that was a big picture kind of a story. And then I was in kind of a quiet phase of my career. I didn't have a new research idea in mind 10, 12 years ago when I stumbled on this wrong way greenhouse gas trend.
Now, when you kind of put forward this idea that there's a mismatch between what we think should have been happening naturally and what we actually see in terms of methane levels or greenhouse gas levels, it was very controversial. How did colleagues respond to this? I mean, was there a professional consequence to you in putting forward this idea?
You mean a negative consequence?
Yes.
I had criticism from a wide variety of sources, but I also had interest and support. So I think from the beginning, it's been a mixed reception to the hypothesis, and it's still being debated. This is a real honest to God climate debate as opposed to the modern anthropogenic greenhouse gas warming, which is not a debate. That's settled science. But aside from a little criticism that was occasionally intemperate, I should say, most of it was done in a professional way, and that's how science works. You put out a new idea, it gets kicked around and kicked at, and everybody evaluates it and goes back and forth and back and forth. And that's what's been happening for 10 years. But there was no directly obvious negative, net negative consequence. I've been able to get funding from National Science Foundation to continue studying this, even though reviewers will say, well, I'm not sure I believe it, but it's an interesting idea. It should be funded. So I think it's a good comment on the operation of the funding system in this country.
Well, right. Not everybody has to agree with the idea, but if it has enough support to seem rational, it's something that we should investigate.
Right. And a few years ago, the National Science Foundation had a top-down request to its program managers to identify potentially transformative, that was the buzzword, I think it still is for a few years, transformative research. And our proposal within the area that I was funded by was put at the top of the list. It's a way of saying this is not settled science, but it has the potential to change how people look at, well, in this case, the history of humans and their effects on climate. So again, I think it's a positive mark in support of how we do science in this country.
Now, 10 years after or 12 years after first proposing this idea, pointing out the mismatch and saying there's a possible explanation and it's us, humans, this still isn't settled science, but is it gaining ground? Do you feel that this is gaining acceptance?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I usually think it is, but sometimes I run into somebody, including one person here at Woods Hole, who says, I don't hear anybody talking about this. And that sets me back. But I think it is gaining ground, at least among the people who go out in the field and study the effects of humans on landscapes, the archaeologists, the paleoecologists, the people who study river sediment deposits and things like that. There's a pervasive awareness of this hypothesis and a lot of interest in it. I would say there's been maybe 4 or 5 dozen papers on various aspects of this issue published in the last 5 years. So that's indicative of interest. And the news media cover, right, some sort of an article appears every two or three a year appear on it. So there's definitely a level of interest. But there are portions of the scientific community who don't think much about the human aspect, early human aspect, which you would get through archaeology or paleoecology. And they tend to either be more hostile or maybe just more ignorant of the hypothesis. So it's really hard to summarize whether it's gaining ground or not. I think it is, but I'm always suspicious of my own biases, so who knows?
Well, and as you alluded to, this is not a question that you can answer with strictly the geology, paleoclimate tools that oceanographers or climate scientists tend to use. You do have to start drawing on archaeologists, anthropologists, all of these other different kinds of science to start to get a handle on it.
That's true. I think there is a natural bias on the part of some of the more physically oriented scientists, the ones you just mentioned, to discount the early anthropogenic effects, because they're looking for lessons about how is the natural climate system behaving in the absence of humans. So if you think that humans weren't a factor 4,000 years ago, then you can use that time as a natural laboratory for what happened after 1850 when the bigger impacts came in. So that's a bias to ignore the human effects. But the archaeologists, a select few, have just jumped on this. And so there are maps now appearing of the spread of agriculture through Southeast Asia, through Africa, and the Americas as well. The American Native Americans were very active agriculturalists. They domesticated about half the foods that we routinely eat nowadays. So people are starting to map and graph the spread, and that's very much that's been the second major factor in acceptance of the hypothesis. I showed the wrong way greenhouse gas trends. That's kind of, I think of that as a kind of a top-down argument, but the archaeological data is showing what the people were doing on the landscape, and that's a bottom-up argument. And the two of them are starting to come to meet in a double-edged argument.
That's Dr. Bill Ruddeman, Professor Emeritus at University of Virginia. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Here's something to ponder. What if human-caused climate change didn't start 150 years ago, but rather 7,000 years ago? That's the idea we're discussing today. With me is Dr. Bill Ruddeman, Professor Emeritus at University of Virginia. He's the one who first proposed the idea that the rise of agriculture thousands of years ago led to rising levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. One of those gases was methane, a relatively short-lived but powerful greenhouse gas. Bill Ruddeman, what was going on 5,000 years ago when methane levels began to rise?
What was happening in, this starts in China, but what was happening in China and the rest of that tropical, subtropical belt was the monsoon was actually weakening. And so natural rainfall was decreasing. And people were growing crops depending on natural rainfall, and the natural rainfall was falling off. So they devised rice agriculture. They domesticated strains of rice that grew in standing water in rice paddies. And it starts in China in the Yangtze River Valley 5,000 years ago. And by 1,000 years ago, it spread everywhere where rice is grown today, all the way down into Indonesia, southern India, Japan, areas like that. So that's been beautifully mapped by Dorian Fuller at the University College of London. And that rise, that appearance of irrigated rice 5,000 years ago matches the reversal of the methane trend. And the spread of rice matches the continuing increase in methane.
So why do these wetlands, why do rice paddies give off methane?
You can think of it as a swamp, except this is a man-made swamp, but there's standing water, there's vegetation growing, and the oxygen in the water of these rice paddies, as in natural wetlands, the oxygen gets used up, and the carbon that's in the vegetation that dies, now it can't combine with oxygen to form CO2. It combines with the hydrogen in the water. So you get bubbles coming up. Probably most everybody has experienced seeing bubbles in stagnant water, the swamp gas it's sometimes called. So that's really what methane is. That's one source. The other, another major source is livestock, which emit methane at both ends of their digestive system, and they start to proliferate in heavily populated areas around 5,000 years ago as well. That's not as well mapped, but there's a major project in Europe to map it right now.
Now, today, I mean, we tend to hear a lot about livestock as a potential source of methane, not so much rice paddies or irrigated or areas or wetlands.
They're both livestock is a larger source, but I forget the ratios, but it's sort of like 3-2 or 4-3. They're both very substantial.
But 5,000 years ago, it was the opposite just because of the numbers?
We don't know at this point because the spread of livestock, there are not yet enough archaeological data on that to get a feeling for how extensive livestock were. So I early on seized on rice irrigation because I knew there were more data to show that really did start at 5,000, which is the magic number. at that point, 10 years ago, we didn't have that data for livestock. Now one paper's published a map of the spread of livestock, and it's looking to be centered on 5,000 years ago. But the relative sizes back then, that's still an open question. There's a ton of work to be done by archaeologists, and a lot of the work could be done with data that's in their labs right now, in their files. We just need more syntheses of the existing data, much less efforts in the field to get new data.
Now, the timeline matches up nicely, the 5,000 years, the appearance of these practices. In a quantitative sense, can we account for the full increase in methane emissions that we see in the geological record based on these two sources?
There's one paper, it's the one I mentioned a few minutes ago, that converts the appearance of rice agriculture in different areas and then makes an assumption as to the increase in irrigated area as populations increased in the past. And that paper estimated between 5,000 and 1,000 years ago, there was a rise of 100 parts per billion. That's the units of the gas in the ice cores. There was an observed rise of 100 parts per billion, and the model of what the rice was contributing is 70. So right there, you've got the majority of the rise, and you haven't even considered the livestock, for which nobody's yet made an estimate. So it looks good.
Now, the other part of this story is carbon dioxide.
Right.
Which I guess you could argue if methane's the second most important, I guess carbon dioxide's going to be your most important greenhouse gas, and that's the one that starts a little bit earlier.
More like 7,000, right. And there's lots and lots of data also in the archaeological records. The two that are most worth citing, there's data showing the spread of the Fertile Crescent crops and livestock, all these things that were domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, the Eastern Mediterranean, starting 11,000, 10,000 years ago. By 8,000 years ago, they're starting to spread into Europe and across Europe. So this includes wheat and barley and other peas and lentils and things like that. It includes cattle, goats, sheep, and pigs. It's just almost all the livestock that we use today. They all are domesticated in this one area that had natural precursors that could be domesticated. And then it spreads across Europe. And by 5,000 years ago, all of Europe has, every place where there's agriculture today has at least some agriculture 5,000 years ago. So that's a good match to the reversal of the CO2 trend, which has been going down between 11,000 and 7,000 years ago, and then starts to head up about 7,000 years ago. And there's data that hasn't really been mined in China showing an explosion of archaeologically dated dwellings and things like that. It just shows a massive population increase between about 7,000 and 4,000 years ago. So the data that exist are favorable to the carbon dioxide change. And carbon.
So how does this transition to agriculture and the spread of agriculture translate into carbon dioxide emissions?
It's pretty simple. Early agriculture has to be done in areas with natural rainfall or along irrigated flood, rivers, basically. But most of it, broadly speaking, is out in areas where you need natural rainfall. And so those are naturally forested because there's abundant rainfall. So to do agriculture, to grow crops or to have pastures for livestock, you need to clear the forest and let the sun in to grow the crops or to let to get the trees and let the pastures flourish for the livestock. So it's basically, as agriculture spreads, you burn the forests. And that puts carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
How were they actually, was it just by burning the forest, or how were they actually cutting down trees this early?
That's a good question, because that spread of agriculture across Europe, that initial spread I was talking about between 8,000 and 5,000 years ago, that's the Stone Age. That's the late Stone Age, or Neolithic, as people call it. So people had very sophisticated, very sharp flint axes that were developed in Israel. And basically all they did was girdle the trees, chop a notch all the way around the circumference of the tree, and that stops the sap from flowing up to the tree. The tree dies. It starts to shower debris into the forest floor, and you let that go on a while, and then you wait for a dry season in what's a fairly moist climate. You wait for inevitable dry period, and you set it on fire. So one person with a flint axe could I forget the exact numbers, could easily clear acres and acres of forest in a winter just by girdling the trees and having them die and setting them on fire. And they'd had fire for a long, long time, so that was nothing new.
So how widespread and how pervasive was the deforestation thousands of years ago?
That's a complex question. You can see this first arrival of agriculture, which requires deforestation, but turning that into numbers is difficult. But there's been some work done by Jed Kaplan in Switzerland showing that there's a problem or a question that there were relatively few people 6,000, 5,000 years ago, meaning a few millions of people maybe on the face of the earth. But each person was using a huge amount of land, much more than we use today. They do this girdling of the trees. They burn the trees, and then they use sticks to plant. They called them dibbles to plant seeds in the soil, which had been sweetened by the ash so it wasn't so acidic. It was more neutral. And they get about 3 or 4 years of crops, and then the soil would play out because they didn't know much, if anything, about use of fertilizers, manure especially. And so they just have to move on and burn another piece and then another piece. And so they kept burning these another sequence and another area, and they left this trail of burned out, not restored forest behind them. So it was a huge effect. Over time, by the time you get to, the year 1600 or 1700, people are using something like one-fifth as much land per person, maybe even one-tenth. And the reason is they've learned to use manure and rotate crops and get more food out of, they can stay on the same piece of land and even plant crops twice a year because they're managing the land better. And the reason they're doing that is because the population is increasing and they have to. They can't just move around in the forest freely and take advantage of a virgin forest. They have to stay on the piece of land they've now been restricted to and make it work, and they do.
I mean, we tend to think of our environmental impact per person today as being much greater than it was in the past. And in some ways it is, but in some ways, you know, we're using, you know, maybe an acre per person or whatever it is. And it was multiple times that we were much more land intensive thousands of years ago.
Yeah, that's true. It's a complicated comparison because by the time you get to 1850 or 1900, you now have John Deere plows and you have McCormick reapers and things like that. And so fewer and fewer people are farmers. Most people are not farmers by the time you get into the 1900s, where everybody was a farmer way back when, or almost everybody. So our impact per person is much less. We're getting much more food off of the per acre of available land. So it's a kind of a mixture. We're having a larger net impact, but much smaller per person because there were just so many of us that were overwhelming the system. And of course, we're doing all these other things that you mentioned at the beginning of environmental degradation that's new to the last 200 years.
Now, one thing that we tend to think of as being new is the use of fossil fuels, but you've also found, scientists have found, that the history of burning coal, at least in China, goes back thousands of years potentially.
There's a kind of a scattered literature. It's mostly based on historical documents. There's a book that quotes some Chinese writer as saying near the town of Kaifeng, which is, I think, northeast, north central China, is saying 2,000 years ago, no one burns wood, everyone burns coal. That's just a sentence abstracted from a historical document that's dealing with other things. And there was just a paper a couple of weeks ago that showed that people were burning coal in the Yellow River Valley, which is where the really early Chinese agriculture began 4,500 years ago. And the reason appears to be that the pollen records from that area show that the trees were gone. I mean, they'd basically
they'd already deforested it for agriculture.
They deforested. And northern China gets a very cold blast of air out of the Siberia most of the winter. So it's cold and windy and dry and not very nice. And you need a heat source. And they ran out of wood, and they discovered that this interesting stuff that was outcropping right at the surface in pit mines, they could just go in there and hammer out some coal and burn it all winter and stay relatively warm.
Now, whereas with the methane story, the rice paddies and the livestock seem to basically account for the geological record. In the case of carbon dioxide, we don't have as complete or certainly not as perfect a fit between what we see in terms of rising carbon dioxide levels and being able to explain it.
That's true. The progress in the last few years has been that people who do simulations of net land use, which is net deforestation, have found that if you account for this early higher land use clearance per person, this clearing the forest and then moving on to another plot and then another plot, if you account for that, you get lots more early deforestation, which is an earlier rise in CO2. And so what comes out of that is an estimate that there was three times as much land cleared before 1850 as has been cleared since. That's a new estimate. So that's moving in the direction of what this wrong way trend in CO2. It's a good step in the direction of explaining that. But there's still such an early rise in CO2, 6,000, 5,000, 4,000 years ago, compared to what has been people's estimates of the population increase, which rises much faster after 2000. It looks like a mismatch, and that's what's been interesting me for the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not working so much on the problem myself as finding people who have the expertise that I can work with them.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Bill Ruderman about the long history of human-caused climate change. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Dr. Bill Ruderman, Professor Emeritus at University of Virginia. Before the break, you were talking about research that has started to close the gap between the geological record of carbon dioxide levels and our estimates of how much carbon dioxide humans could possibly have been generating thousands of years ago. Where does that stand?
So what's one thing that's come out from a couple sources of evidence is something that's a really new view of how our populations grew over the course of this early agricultural interval. Used to be thought that populations stayed low. They might double every 1,000 years, but they started so low that it took a lot of doublings before it got to be a large number. Now, the evidence is suggesting that when agriculture first arrives in an area, there's a real population explosion.
I mean, that makes sense. It's such a game changer in terms of the amount of food that you're able to produce as opposed to gathering.
And people... These first farmers, you think of them, they have this new skill, this new technology. They come into an area, and here are all they look out in the landscape, and there's these beautiful, heavily forested, well-watered valleys with thick soils and plenty of groundwater, and they burn the forest, and that's where they do their agriculture. And in time, if you think of it just on the scale of a couple of valleys, the valleys start to fill up with people, but population's still growing. And so the people that are there have to start going up the hillsides and farming land where the soils are not so thick, the rainfall's not so steady, the water level in the soils is not so good because the water flows down slope and erosion occurs if they do too much clearing and don't do it sensibly. So the growth rate slows because people are having later arrivals, like thousands of years later, having trouble making as good a living as the early arrivals. So if you use those kind of population curves, population comes up much earlier than had been thought. So right now there's a reevaluation, I'll call it a small revolution in thinking about population increases. And the upshot of that is the population increases were earlier than had been thought, and they were using much more land than had been thought. And those two factors multiply together and explain, they're pushing, they're eliminating the mismatch between what had been the assumed population curves and the CO2 curves. It now looks like there was an enormous amount of clearance 6,000, 5,000, 4,000 years ago. I think from the literature I've read, by 2,000 years ago, Europe was deforested, China was deforested, India was deforested, and a lot of other areas were partially deforested. That's a lot of carbon dioxide.
And about that point, is that about the point where population growth starts to slow down again?
Population growth doesn't come up as fast until, with the exception, after about 1600, population really explodes. But that's because of health sanitation measures. All the diseases that started to cull population once you got cities and large accumulations of people that slowed population growth, pandemics, plagues, things like that. People begin to learn where diseases come from, bad water and things like that. And once sanitation improves, and then later on medicine provides solutions, then the population explodes heading into the modern recent centuries.
Now, talk about the cumulative impact of all of these early greenhouse gas emissions. It's much slower. We're talking about accumulating or releasing greenhouse gases over the past 5 to 6, 7 thousand right. years, as opposed to the last 150, 200 years. But the total amount released over that very long period was more than we've actually produced in the past 150, 200 years.
And considered in terms of deforestation only, that's correct. There was more land cleared and more forest carbon burned and sent to the atmosphere. After 1800, 1850, you're starting to add fossil fuels, and they become the largest source of CO2. Deforestation gets in the news a lot, but it's really fossil fuels that's driving our CO2 increase. So there was a large increase, larger than expected increase back then. We've done some calculations, we being some modelers, John Kutzbach and Steve Vavris at the University of Wisconsin, and some model simulations that those early greenhouse gas emissions kept global climate at least a degree centigrade warmer than it would have been. Climate was naturally cooling because of the orbital variations, but it ended up cooling very little because the early agricultural greenhouse gas emissions canceled most of that cooling. And our simulations suggest that if the farmers had not been putting those gases into the atmosphere, there would be small ice sheets now in northern Siberia, northern Canada, Alaska, Labrador up in the northeast Canadian archipelago. There would be small ice sheets. You could call that a new glaciation. You could call it a embryonic glaciation, but they would be there, areas where the snow never melts, and then it starts to pile up year after year. So if you wanted to be say something attention-getting, you could say we stopped a glaciation. That's a bit strong. But we stopped the early, I think we stopped the early stages of a glaciation. The farmers did this before we even got into the anthropogenic era. And now there's not going to be another glaciation for tens of thousands of years because the CO2 level is too high and it's going to stay too high. So it's kind of amazing. These glacial cycles have been going on 3 million years, almost 3 million years, and we've stopped them.
Now, talk about the bubonic plague. Okay. If we're making the argument that humans have already been influencing climate for thousands of years, we see a major decrease in the human population. I mean, the plague put a serious dent in human population, at least in Europe. Were there climatic repercussions of the plague?
When I first got into this 10 years ago, I claimed there were some drops in carbon dioxide, not huge, 5 or 10 parts per million, as compared to the slow long-term rise of about 40 parts per million. There were drops of 5 or 10 parts per million, but they seemed to, I didn't know what they were, and they seemed to coincide with pandemics, I called them multi-continental outbreaks of disease, and later came to find that also some of them were affected by civil strife, by warfare. Genghis Khan and his people going into China, ripping up the infrastructure in China and all the way across to Iraq. So there looked to be a connection between the two. And the big one, the major link I came to find later was there's the largest of the CO2 drops occurs between 1525 and 1610 or 1620. And 1525 is just about the time that the conquistadors get into the Inca strongholds and the strongholds in Mexico. And the people, anthropologists now estimate that there were 50 or 60 million people in the Americas before Columbus, much larger than people thought a few decades ago, based on a lot of archaeological work. And they estimate that 80 to 90% of them died in a relatively short period of time because these people had no immunity to most of the European diseases. Most of the European diseases come out of livestock, and that the Native Americans didn't have livestock except for llama and alpaca up in the mountains of the Andes. So they didn't have immunity to the diseases, and so just simple contact with the Europeans and their livestock is accountable for just probably the largest human disaster, at least in percentage terms.
Perhaps 30, 40 million people, you know.
Well, if you go from 55 to maybe 7 or 10, it's almost 50 million people, but more than that.
And you can see that then in the geological record.
It's a huge fraction of the population. So all these people die. Most Native Americans are farming corn and beans and tomatoes and avocados and things like that. And they die. And there's not so many people in the Americas that there's somebody next door that can just come in and take over your farm if you die. If you die, your farm just reverts to its natural state, which is forest. And so the Americas were more deforested in 1490 than they were in 1500 or 1600 or really almost till around 1700. And then the real European wave of people begins after 1700. And then it's a re-deforestation that the Europeans do. But the Native Americans had done an awful lot of deforestation. So when they die, their agricultural land reverts to forest, and that pulls CO2 out of the atmosphere, and that drops the concentration of CO2 in these ice core air bubbles that can be measured.
We are now putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at a much faster pace than we have over the past 5 or 7,000 years. But I wonder if this understanding of a very long impact of humans on the climate alters your perception of the risks of current human-caused climate change in any way?
It doesn't really change my opinion in a major way. I am one of the 97% or so of mainstream climate scientists that says the climate is growing warm. We are the major cause. Our greenhouse gases are the major cause. And we haven't done anything really large to make me optimistic that we're not going to keep warming our climate to potentially dangerous levels. And so what I've done is add a chapter, an early chapter to that, but I'm not changing what we know about the last 100 years and what we project for the future 100 years. I'm just, my hypothesis and the work that supports it says it's, I guess you could say it's more a matter of academic understanding that it's good to know more about where you came from and what you did. It does take some of the onus off the industrial era as being the big bad thing that we've done to climate. The largest thing we've done to Earth's surface is clear land for agriculture, and we did that very early, sometimes with stone axes. So it just enlarges your scope. There's one cause for optimism in what I've read, which it was around the edges of what I was just telling you, and that is as the landscape became crowded with people and they couldn't just move around and do this inefficient slash and burn agriculture, it's called, they got more and more clever about how to get more food off the land. So by innovating, technology, you could call it, but manuring, rotating crops, all those factors. So it's a commentary on humans, I guess, that we're this overwhelming force on the landscape, but we are capable of learning from circumstances and, in this case, innovating in a way to accommodate ever-growing populations. We haven't had phenomenal population collapses because of famine over those thousands of years, as Malthus once thought we would, because humans have innovated and figured a way around it. So I like to, if I have any serious hope for the future and the oncoming problems with global warming, it is that something in the technological era area will come along to lessen our impacts. If I had to put my money on something, it would be some phenomenally powerful battery that allowed us to store power from wind sources or solar sources, store enough power that we didn't have to rely on backup power sources to get electricity. So, and people are working like crazy on these innovations. So there's some cause for hope that we will avoid the worst effects of future global warming if we continue to innovate as our ancestors did thousands of years ago. Innovation gets us into trouble, and then we get ourselves back out of trouble. It's a funny mix.
Bill Roderman, thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.